This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In his new book, The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel, How Two Brave Scientists Battled Typhus and Sabotaged the Nazis, Politico eHealth editor Arthur Allen tells the true story of the battle against disease and genocidal ideology, told through the lives of microbiologists Rudolf Weigel and Ludwig Fleck. The two fought typhus and cruelty from the Russian POW camps of World War I to the ghettos and concentration camps of Nazi-occupied Europe. Arthur Allen joins us this afternoon, along with the executive director for the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education, Sarah Weiss. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Arthur and Sarah, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Arthur, I understand you're originally from Cincinnati?
I am. I grew up in Avondale off of Washington Avenue. One of our close family friends was Lucia Hornstein, and her son Frank was a good friend of mine. And it turns out that Lucia actually grew up in Lviv, which is the city that I write about in this book. It's now Lviv in Ukraine.
It's a fascinating book, and I think we have to start off by talking, because you don't hear much about typhus anymore. I think we have to start off talking about what typhus is and just what a mm-hmm. what a horrible disease it was.
Yeah, I mean, typhus is a disease that's mostly gone. It's in a few very far-flung places possibly in the Andes and in the mountains of Ethiopia. It's a disease. It's a bacterial disease. It's only spread by body lice, which are not the same as head lice that, you know, so many kids get in school and continue to, including my kids. Luckily, body lice are really carried mostly by people who just don't get to change their clothes very often. And they've pretty much been eradicated in most Western societies by treatment of clothes, and then they just aren't around anymore. And so typhus was this disease that by the early part of the 20th century was still endemic to parts of Eastern Europe and Russia. During the Russian Revolution, there was probably the worst epidemic in history. There were as many as 6 million people who died in it. And it's really just a disease that occurs when there's a complete breakdown of society and people don't have to wear lots of layers of clothes to stay warm, and they, you know, can't bathe, and also malnutrition doesn't help with the disease.
And this is not to be confused with typhoid, right? They're completely different.
Right. Yeah, it's a very common mistake. There is typhoid. The reason they have the same name is because, as is true with a lot of diseases, you know, there's something called influenza, and then there's parainfluenza. It just means that they realized that they were two separate diseases, and that was the case with typhoid. Originally, it was called typhus, and then they started calling it typhoid because typhoid fever is actually also a bacteria but carried in water, not by lice, and it's just an entirely different organism, although people sometimes have similar symptoms in terms of, you know, terrible fevers and body rashes and things that was why they were confused. It was confused and thought to be the same disease in the first place. So typhoid is still spread by dirty water, mostly in, you know, the third world, not so much in the U.S. or Western Europe, places like that anymore.
Why body lice, not head lice? I mean, why the distinction there between who transmits the disease?
Yeah, it's really kind of striking and lucky for us, but because they're very similar insects, but they live in slightly different climates, and your head is a hotter place. And for some reason, I think in a laboratory, scientists have managed to infect head lice with typhus. But just in the wild, they never carried typhus. And they have different kind of behaviors, which probably would limit how it spread, because one of the really kind of gruesome things about typhus is that body lice live in this very narrow range of temperatures, and they feed on your body, and then they retreat into your clothes. And if your body gets too hot, they leave. So they leave when you have a high fever. Also, if you cool down, that is, if you've passed away. And so that's how the disease spread, because the lice would flee someone's body when they were either extremely feverish or dying or dead and jump onto other people.
You know, individually, we're talking about what leads to typhus. You make an interesting statement at the beginning of the book about epidemics, that typhus mm-hmm. epidemics occur when a population is at the end of its tether. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, a disease like polio or even measles, whooping cough, many of the epidemic diseases that are a little bit more familiar to us, are not really diseases that strike only a certain class of people. I mean, polio, of course, you know, in the United States in the 40s and 50s, it was, or 30s, 40s, so on, it was a terrible disease that really hit anyone, any class. FDR had polio. And typhus is a disease that really happens in the current day and age when people change their clothes, which has been, well, I don't know, the last 200 years or so, then most parts of the world people change their clothes in days. And so when the only times now in the sort of modern era when that no longer happens is when people are at the end of their tether, when they're in conditions of warfare or starvation or at a battlefront or at a concentration camp where there's no running water, where you can't change your clothes because it's cold and you only have one change of clothes. So people, it tends to only, you know, in this century, in the last century, most of it was really a disease of these extremes. But especially by the time that people realized that it was carried by lice and that it was, you know, not a threat if you didn't have lice, and you only had lice, you didn't change your clothes.
We will continue our discussion about the fantastic laboratory of Dr. Weigel. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Arthur Allen, author of The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel, How Two Brave Scientists Battled Typhus and Sabotaged the Nazis, and the executive director for the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education, Sarah Weiss. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Sarah, Arthur is going to be in town to discuss his book. That's coming up at an event on November 1st. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So Arthur is our featured speaker of the Hornstein Annual Hornstein Lecture, which is a lecture in memory of Stephen and Lucia Hornstein, who were Holocaust survivors, who made their lives in the greater Cincinnati community. Both became doctors themselves and made a huge impact on our community. And every year we have a lecture in their memory and their honor, and their children are very involved. And so he'll be our featured speaker for that talk Sunday, November 1st at 10 a.m. at Wise Temple, it's open, and we welcome the community to come.
Is there a website where people can get more information about that?
Yeah, thank you. www.holocaustandhumanity.org. There's information all about the lecture.
Okay, and that's at wvxu.org as well. Arthur, how big of a problem was typhus during World War I, World War II? I mean, how big an effect did it have?
Well, first I wanted to say, just to point out, that the Hornsteins were really extraordinary people, and they were friends of my family. I feel really privileged to be giving this lecture because they were remarkable people and great help to Cincinnati. So typhus during World War I was a big problem, but by then, within about five or 10 years before the war, scientists had discovered for the first time, they had confirmed that lice were the carriers of typhus. So if you look at photographs from World War I and even read the literature, like All Quiet on the Western Front, you often see references to delicing, where soldiers would get together and pick the nits and lice off of their bodies and did this sort of in their spare time. This is when they weren't, you know, shooting at each other with mortars and rockets and so on. But it was a pretty bad problem on the Eastern Front, nonetheless. The Germans protected themselves fairly well. The Russians and Poles and others on the Eastern Front not so well. But this was the start of sort of the first efforts to make a vaccine against typhus, and this is where the two characters in my book come in. Rudolf Weigel was actually a zoologist, and Ludwig Fleck was one of his assistants at a lab that was initially run by the Austro-Hungarian, military in Chemish, which is a town in far eastern Poland now. And then after the war, that became part of Poland. It had been part of Austro-Hungary, and then they both moved to Lviv, and this is it's actually spelled L-W-O-W in Poland, or L-V-I-V in Ukrainian. And this became the center of this incredible vaccine that Weigel produced, which was actually grown in lice, which meant that he would inject typhus germs into the bodies of lice using sort of microscopic eyepieces and micro injectors that he devised himself. He was like the DIY uncle from hell. I mean, he was an incredible inventor.
Well, that's amazing, too, that something as small as a louse, he's able to actually inject it with this. That's just
millions of times. Because to make this vaccine, you needed about 100 lice. I forget the numbers, but for a simple dose, you need about 100 lice. You're talking about when you're trying to produce this vaccine for armies, which is what happened during World War II. Weigel's lab was taken over by the German army, and his lab became kind of a refuge for everybody in Lviv who was threatened by the Nazis, including some Jews, although not very many of them, and I'll talk about that later. But so everyone is in his lab, and they're feeding most of them. Their job was to feed lice, and what that meant was they would put about 500 lice in a little matchbox-sized box, and each person would strap maybe 20 of these boxes to their legs for an hour, and the lice fed on their blood.
Cool.
So it's what's kind of amazing about it is as horrible and kind of gothic as that sounds.
I'm squirming in my seat right now.
Yes. Everyone in Lviv wanted to work in this lab because you got extra food rations. The Nazis were terrified of typhus because they considered it a Jewish disease that had all kinds of, not only the real physical threat of it, but all kinds of sort of symbolic meaning to them that was part of their perversion of science and their perversion of the concepts of race and so on. So they kept their hands off of people there. And in fact, the resistance, the Polish resistance, was based in Weigel's laboratory during the war.
So this gave him good cover. Yeah. This was a good cover operation then.
It was a little bit like Schindler's factory, except it wasn't really for Jews. It was mainly for Poles, but who nonetheless were quite persecuted by the Nazis, and many of whom were helping Jews. So then, as for the Jewish population of Lviv, they, were, like the rest of Poland, were victimized in just unimaginable ways. If you think that there are perhaps 150,000 Jews who died there during the war. But among the survivors was a small group of scientists whom Weigel had tried to protect, and he gave them identification cards that helped protect them. And they ended up making their own vaccine in the ghetto hospital. And this caught the attention of the Nazis, who were desperate for typhus vaccine because they weren't prepared for World War II in terms of equipment, clothing, and their troops at the Eastern Front started coming down with typhus not long after they invaded Russia. So they were desperate for vaccine, and so they saved the lives of these Jewish scientists and had them working on a vaccine at Buchenwald, which is hard to wrap your mind around, that there was actually science in a form going on in this concentration camp. But the SS doctors, who are notorious and mostly completely incompetent and horrible bunch of people, they would make themselves special by, showing Himmler or their other bosses, look, I'm doing something scientific in this lab, and they sort of hoped that eventually this would lead to jobs after the war as big professors in the German universities. So this was how this laboratory was created, and in fact, the vaccine that they were producing there, which used another method, which was also rather gruesome, it involved rabbit lungs. I won't get into the details too much. But,
thank you.
but it was a fake vaccine. Over 16 months, they made a vaccine that was not a real vaccine. The inmates knew it wasn't a vaccine. The Nazi boss thought it was.
Subverted the Nazis. Yeah. Okay.
That's how they subverted them. And meanwhile, they eventually got enough know-how that they were able to make a real vaccine, which they used to vaccinate some of the inmates in the camp who were in danger. So they were not only subverting the Nazi war effort by giving them fake vaccine, they were also secretly vaccinating their own people in the camps who were at most risk, like people who were around bodies a lot or who were in the infirmary and so on.
Sarah, why is it so important to get this story out there?
You know, the amazing thing is there are so many incredible stories. This is a story I had no idea.
I had never heard this before.
Until actually Frank Hornstein, the son of Lucia and Stephen Hornstein, brought it to my attention. And it's an incredible story. Dr. Weigel's work and, you know, trying to fight an incredible, unbelievable epidemic during the time, but at the same time trying to save individuals, being involved in the resistance, continuing with this, the story of Buchenwald, Dr. Fleck and his work. And these are stories that should be known. And during this time, during World War II, as the Holocaust is going on, inside a camp, there's somebody working to, at the same time, save lives and try to sabotage, to a certain extent, the Nazis. It's incredible. It's an incredible story.
Arthur,
I just wanted to add one other thing. I'm sorry. It's just that one thing that really struck me about both of these men is they were completely human, normal human beings. They loved science. They were both Polish, very much identified as Polish. Fleck was Jewish also, but he liked living in Lviv. People really liked that city. And you know, it connects to the Hornsteins because these are people who are dedicated professionals. Mm-hmm. And really, the Holocaust, that's kind of one of the things that, I mean, one way that I could understand the Holocaust in a clearer way was to think about, like, what did professionals, like people like me, okay? I mean, it's always easier to sort of relate to people who kind of have your way of life. And these were people, I mean, they were extraordinary, but they were sort of professionals like me, like the Hornsteins, who did these incredible things under unbelievable circumstances.
Us, yeah.
Arthur, we've got about a minute left. How did the world view Dr. Weigel? How was he viewed? Was he viewed as a hero, or was there a lot of misunderstanding about him?
Well, all around the world, other types of scientists looked to him and communicated with him in the 30s. After the war, he kind of disappeared. The Polish... anything that happened in the territory that became part of the Soviet Union was really shoved under the rug, unfortunately, after World War II by the communist government. And Weigel, you know, was not put in a camp or something, but he was pretty much, there were rumors that he'd been a collaborator, which in a sense he was a collaborator. I mean, he had to collaborate to survive and protect people, but he was making this vaccine for the Germans. There were a lot of professional jealousies, and he sort of died in obscurity and is only... in the last 10 or 15 years, really come back to the knowledge of Polish people.
What about Ludwig Fleck? What about Ludwig Fleck?
Fleck is a little better known among philosophy students because, in addition to his work as a microbiologist, he was also a philosopher of science and had some very interesting observations, which I find quite interesting too, which is a whole other hour.
Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Arthur Allen is author of The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel, How Two Brave Scientists Battled Typhus and Sabotaged the Nazis, and the executive director for the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education, Sarah Weiss. Arthur Allen's going to be in town to discuss his book Sunday at the Isaac M. Weiss Temple. You can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier, and the assistant producer, Belinda Kai. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7. 10 Republican presidential hopefuls take to the stage for debate number 3 as Ben Carson passes Donald Trump for the first time in a national poll. Hillary Clinton solidifies her frontrunner status after the first Democratic debate. Meantime, Vice President Joe Biden decides not to make a run for the White House. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll have a look at the latest from the world of politics with political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. That's Cincinnati Edition, Thursday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.